by Brian related to neutron star mergers. So let's start with an introduction about the origin of heavy elements. I like this very old figure where we have here the abundances, a schematic figure, and a mass number. So we see that the abundances here drop very fast. Those elements are produced in different burning stages during the life of a star. The slope here is totally different because those elements are produced by neutron captures, rapid or slow, compared to beta decay. And here we can see that there is the fingerprint of the nuclear physics in the abundance. So the elements with highest abundances here, iron group nuclei, are elements with highest binding energy. We see also the double peaks here related with magic neutron numbers. And in that way, we can look at the abundances, understand which process produced those abundances, and then look for the astrophysical environment where the conditions that we need to for those processes. And once we have simulated those environments with hydrodynamical simulation, as we have seen here, we can study the nucleosynthesis and go back to the abundances and see if our assumptions, our microphysics in the nucleosynthesis and in the simulations was correct, if we are able to reproduce abundances. So I will concentrate on the air process and say something about the neutrino beam process. So the air process is the rapid neutron capture. So what we have here is only a piece of the nuclear charge. So here are in black stable nuclei. And in the air process, what happens is that nuclei capture a lot of neutrons, go far from stability to this red path here, and then to go up, they have to wait to beta decay. So they can go to the right by neutron capture and up by beta decays. And what we see is there is magic numbers where no more neutron captures are possible, so matter accumulates here until beta decay happens, and this will lead to these peaks we have seen in the abundances. And the position of these peaks will tell us how extreme the conditions should be in order to get it there. And we know that we need huge neutron abundances. So then the second point will be, okay, where can we find, in which astrophysical scenario can we find these extreme neutron-rich conditions? And there are several candidates, but the favorite sites are core collapse supernova and neutron star mergers. So let me give an overview of what are the possibilities in the core collapse supernova. The favorite and best study possibility is the neutrino-driven wind, but as I will explain later, you will see that it's not that appropriate to produce very, very heavy nuclei. There are other suggestions like prompt explosion in oxygen-neomagnesium cores, shock surface layers and jets. But let me start with the neutrino-driven wind. So after the explosion, independent of the, we have neutrinos-driven explosion, the SASE helps, if we have some convection. After the explosion, we have a hot proto-neutron star in the center that cools by neutrino emission. So neutrinos deposit the energy in the matter surrounding the proto-neutron star, and this matter expands very fast. In this very fast expansion, neutrons and protons recombine, forming alpha particles, and the alpha particles form seed nuclei. And the point here is, how many neutrons do we have there? How is the neutron to seed ratio? So if there are a lot of neutrons, then this air process, this rapid neutron capture process, can produce even heavier nuclei. And to get these extreme conditions, it's well known that one needs very fast expansion, neutron-rich conditions, of course. The electron fraction should be below 0.5, and this is something that's not found in the last simulations. And we need high entropies. So all the conditions necessary for an air process in the neutrino-driven wind had been already identified in the last 10 years with these nice steady-state models, like the one here from Otsuki. So to form the second and the third peak, we need to have really high entropies and short time scales. And The point is that in the hydrodynamical simulations, we are not getting these very high entropies, and even the last ones, as I say, are not producing neutron-rich conditions at all. So let's go to our overview here. The neutrino-driven wind is facing some problems because it's proton-rich. There is a low entropy. So there was the paper of Woosley et al. In 94, where the entropies were really high, but now Stan, together with his student, Luke, they have in the new paper say that the equation of a state has some problems, and that's why they got these very high entropies at that time. So this is just wrong result. There could be something that it's missing. There could be some multidimensional effect or a neutrino collective oscillation or some other microphysics that is missing and produce the right condition in some of the neutrino-driven wind. Okay, for a prompt explosion, as we have seen yesterday, the explosion is delayed. So this mechanism was proposed a long time ago by Hillebrand et al. Is already excluded. But also in this oxygen neomagnesium star a few years ago, Ningxian and Mayer say that since the run pressure in these low mass progenitors is very low, the shock can expand really fast. And this very fast expansion could make the conditions for the air process favorable, even if the electron fraction is not very neutron rich. And there are some new studies also based on supernova jet like explosions. But these are still very, very preliminary, but there is still work going on in this direction. Okay, since the supernova presents so many problems, people have looked, of course, also into neutron star mergers, where we have neutron-rich material, so the conditions are right for a successful air process. The problem here is this cannot be the only mechanism, because we observe this air process in very old stars. So there are still some uncertainties in the rate of these events or in the amount of mass that is ejected with heavy nuclei in these events, that it's not totally clear if this can explain all the air process that we observe. And I will come back to this a bit later. Okay, so let me show what I've been done in the frame of neutrino-driven winds. I was doing hydrodynamical simulations together with Thomas Janka. We have done one-dimensional simulations up to 10 seconds and two-dimensional simulations for a few seconds. And we have an inner boundary where we put enough neutrinos in order to get an explosion. Of course, this is not good to study the explosion itself, but it's good to see what happens after the explosion, where the nucleosynthesis is going on. And the results are here. So here we have in the center a proto-neutron star. We see the shock here. And we see the colors is entropy. So this local entropy matter goes down to the proto-neutron star, gets energized by neutrinos, and expands in big hot bubbles that deform the shock. And let's see how this continues. So 500 milliseconds after bounce, it looks like that. There is a lot of instabilities going on. And 700 milliseconds after bounce, it looks like that. We have a constant region here. We cannot see anymore the protoneutron star. And this region is the neutrino-driven wind. And what we see is that this wind is not expanding in nothing. It's inside of the ejector, the previous ejecta of the supernova. And what happens is the wind is very fast and collides with this slow-moving ejecta. And this results in a wind termination shock and an increase of the entropy, since the kinetic energy is transformed into internal energy. So 1.5 seconds after bounce, it looks like that. We see here the wind is constant entropy region again. And if you see the form of the wind, is a bit weird, but can be explained. So here we had before a downflow, and this has left a region with a bit higher density, so the wind cannot expand that fast in that direction. And then we see this deformation here. And what is interesting is to compare what happens along different radial directions and compare to 1D. And this is shown here. So here is the density, temperature, and entropy as a function of radius for the lines here, and compared to a 1D in black simulation. So in the wind, what is this region? we see that it's exactly the same. So this indicates that the wind is spherically symmetric. However, the interaction of the wind with the ejecta is differently. So we see that it happens at different radius, and the temperatures are also different. And this could affect the nucleosynthesis, or this affects the nucleosynthesis. Okay, to summarize these simulations, I would like to show a movie. So here you have the entropy and velocity. You have seen here this big downflow, a big hot bubble expanding here, and now this constant entropy region with very high velocities is a neutrino-driven wind. And we see that the deformation of the wind leads to a collimation of matter in some direction. And this is all explained in the paper with Thomas. Okay. So now I will move to the nucleosynthesis. For a nucleosynthesis study, we have used the one-dimensional models. As you have seen, the neutrino-driven wind is spherically symmetric, so we can use our 1D models for them. We have data up to 10, 15 seconds. What we see here is the protein neutron star that contracts, the shock radius that expands, and these dashed lines are massed elements. So massed elements is close to the proton neutron star, get energy for neutrinos, expand very fast in the neutrino-driven wind, and then when it collides with the slow-moving ejecta, the expansion continues, but much slower. And this change of time scales is also important for a nucleosynthesis. And what we do for a nucleosynthesis is we take the evolution of density and temperature along those trajectories, we put this into our nucleosynthesis network and calculate which elements can be produced. And then we know how much mass is ejected in every of those mass elements, so we can integrate and get the integrated abundances that are here. There are some iron group nuclei, some nuclei around set equal 40, but there is no air process. And so what do we want to get, or what can be obtained in neutrino-driven winds? So let me go back to observations again, because it's at the end what we want to reproduce. Here we have observations of ultra-metapure stars. These stars have in their atmosphere the fingerprint of the interstellar medium where they form. And this interstellar medium was contaminated only by one or two nucleosynthesis events. So we are almost observing directly the result of one supernova or one neutron star major or one nucleosynthesis event. And this is shown here by dots. And it's compared with the solar system air process abundances in blue. And what we see is that the relative abundances in this for those elements is exactly the same in the solar system and in this very old star. So this points to a robust air process that was acting in the same way along the life of the galaxy. However, we see that there is some scatter for those elements here. This is the scatter. And this suggests that there are at least two components or two sites producing the heavy elements, one producing those ones, another producing the other ones. And this has, so many people have looked at that, and they have found, for example, using stars that have like this one, this abundance versus as a function of elements, and there are stars that have a high enrichment of these heavy elements and others with low enrichment of those heavy elements, and all of them produce those lighter, heavy elements. This can be, it was called weak air process or charged particle reactions or LEP, light element primary process. We have preferred to call it LEP because this has no physical meaning. So it could be a neutrino process, could be proton capture, could be alpha process, could be many things. And we don't know what it is, so better to call it LEP. And Sheehan and Basabur have suggested that those elements are produced in every neutrino-driven wind after every core collapse supernova. However, those are produced only in some event that we don't know. And Claudia Travaglio and collaborators show that in the solar system we have the air process, the S process, and then there are also another abundances that we cannot explain. They call it LEP, and the abundances that we cannot explain in the solar system abundances, the pattern is the same as what we observe here. And the question is, can we produce this based on simulations? And this is the work I've done together with Fernando Montes. We have looked using the simulations and doing nucleosynthesis calculations. What happens if we assume different evolutions of the electron fraction? Can we produce always those elements? And the answer is yes. Here, assuming proton-rich conditions, we see that we can reproduce the pattern from observations. Even if we change, here are different evolutions of the electron fraction. Even if we change the evolution, we still get this pattern. And also in neutron-rich conditions, those elements are produced, although the pattern is not always the same. And what I think it's very nice here is that if we look at isotopical abundances, and if we compare the isotopical abundances here, not elemental abundances, and compare it to solar, then we get these production factors. And what we see, for example, for strontium is that we are producing mainly this isotope, this neutron-deficient isotope, if the neutrino-driven wind is proton-rich, while if it's neutron-rich, we will produce the isotope with more neutrons. So if we would have isotopical abundances of these ultra-metapure stars, perhaps we could say, if those elements are producing neutrino-driven wind, we could say if it's neutron or proton-rich. We are organizing also together with Chris Sneeden and Marco Pignatari a workshop to try to put together observers and modelers and nucleosynthesis to discuss about those elements and where can be produced and under which conditions. Okay, and now I would like to say a few words about the electron fraction, why we have changed it. And I think this is justified because it's not a perfectly known parameter of in the simulations. So the electron fraction in a very simple way can be written like that, and it depends on the neutrino and antineutrino energies. These energies, as we have seen, are more or less given by the energy of neutrinos where neutrinos decouple from matter. So this would be a piece of the neutron star. Here is inside, outside, and neutrinos are coupled mainly through those reactions. So since we have more neutrons, electron neutrinos keep coupled up to larger radio. This means lower temperature and lower energy, and that looks clear. However, as we have discussed already, there are not only these reactions. And what I want to point out, that it was just briefly mentioned the first day, there is also not only neutrons and protons, there are also light nuclei. There is also deuterium, tritium, and a bit of helium-3. So here, for this sphere, we have assumed a nuclear statistic equilibrium and beta equilibrium. We have here density and temperature, and we see that for 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 gram per cubic centimeter and a few MeV, we have a non-negligible amount of this light cluster. And these are exactly the conditions that we find in the outer layers of the proto-neutron star, and this is something we have looked with, I think, many people in this room. In the other figure is the mass fraction, the log of the mass fraction of all those together, all with between 2 and 4. So we have looked at different times after bounds, 2, 5, 7, and 10 milliseconds, and here are the abundances, the mass fraction of those elements. So we see here, for example, deuterium, tritium, that become important. And what happens is that, so for electron neutrinos, it's the same because they mainly interact with neutrons and we have a lot. But for antineutrinos, if they interact mainly with protons. So if these protons are inside of this deuterium or tritium, then the neutrinos, they will stop interacting earlier because there are less protons, and the neutrinosphere will move to a smaller radio and they will have higher energy. However, at later times, when this deuterium becomes more abundant, the interaction with these light elements, the antineutrino interaction with these light elements, move again the antineutrinosphere to larger radio. And in principle, this is, I think, the reason why we see now that the wind is proton-rich is because there are, okay, those elements are not included in the simulations, but there are other things like Bremsstrahlung. Here is Bremsstrahlung in blue. or the inverse of premestralum. And this becomes also important, and this acts in the same way in all neutrino flavors. So this is moving the antineutrino sphere to larger radii. And this can be summarized with this figure. So here we have antineutrino energy, neutrino energy, and we see that with improvements in the microphysics, in the neutrino reactions, the antineutrino energy have been reduced. And this makes that the matter moves from neutron-rich conditions, as shown by the contours, to proton-rich conditions, since the difference between the energy of both is becoming smaller. And what I find really interesting, and one has to be careful, is this is still not the final answer, because here we have Garkin and Basel, with both use Boltzmann transport, and they have a small difference only in the neutrino reaction set that they use, and this leads to different energies and electron fraction. And this was pointed out in the paper of Hudepohl et al., where with different rate of with different set of neutrino interactions, they found differences in the antineutrino or also in the neutrino energies. Okay, and now let me show what is the effect of the electron fraction on the nucleosynthesis. So here we have abundances versus electron fraction of seed nuclei here. There is at high temperature, assuming anything, there is almost no seed nuclei. We have mainly neutrons in red, protons, and the alphas are in green. And when the temperature drops as matter expands, we see that the amount of seed nuclei increases significantly. Here we have less protons, less neutrons. And when the temperature is even lower, we see we produce a bit more of these seed nuclei. And what the typical neutrino-driven wind a few years ago had was electron fractions of 0.45, so like here. And we see that the neutron-to-seed ratio is very, very small. In order to get a high neutron-to-seed ratio, one has to go here, so neutrons to seed, or even lower. And this is what is in a neutron star mergers, where the electron fraction are around 0.1, 0.2. And other important feature here is the neutrons coming up here in the proton-rich conditions. This is the neutrino P process. Antineutrinos are absorbed on protons and produce a few neutrons, and this is really important because it's what it allows to produce these lead elements in proton-rich conditions. And this is shown here in this movie. So you see how matter builds up, and when we arrive here, it can continue because there is an NP reaction with the neutron coming from this antineutrino absorption on protons. This cannot be possible in a wind where everything happens very fast and the beta decay is very slow. And we see now matter comes back to stability, and at this point the reversal comes, the temperature increases, and this allows again matter to move away from stability and even get higher. This is something we are investigating together with Carla Froelich now. And here you see if we have a proton-rich wind, then we will produce, for example, this isotope, while if we have a neutron-rich wind, we will produce isotopes here. So the abundances that we will observe will be different depending on the neutron richness of the wind. Okay, and now you go very fast to the neutron star mergers because, as I say, Brian will explain things in more detail later. So there are three points that I want to summarize. So the air processing neutron star mergers are important because they contribute to the chemical history of our galaxy. So there was some discussion if they are the main or not the main, or not the only air process site. It could be that they are not the only one, but I'm sure that they contribute. The other important point is that the nuclear reactions going on during the air process produce enough energy to change the dynamic of the merger. And the last point is in the air process, we will produce matter here. and this matter will decay to a stability, and this decay, this radioactive decay, will lead to a light curve that in principle hopefully will be observed. But all this will be explained in more detail by Brian. Let me show only a few slides. So already in the 1990, Freiburghaus and company made some simulations, or Rosbot made the simulations, and they calculate the nucleosynthesis based on those simulations. So you see the electron fraction in mergers are very low, and it's possible to produce this third and second peak of the air process. And the conditions here are low entropy, high neutron densities. There is no alpha, so all the matter in the winter, most of the matter is into alpha, so the amount of energy that it will be produced by the air process is very small, because there is only a small amount of matter going on in the air process. But here, all the matter is into the air process, so it produces a lot of energy. And also, we start already with neutron-rich nuclei. And the problem is here, I think one should repeat this calculation with newer data. This is a galactic chemical evolution model calculation. So here we have abundances of an air process element, barium. This is the red points, our observations. And what we have here is metallicity. So this is today. At this, we will move like that, going back in time to the past of the galaxy. So we see that the amount of this air process have increased. And if we assume a model where this air process is produced by supernovas, we will get these black points, small points that are here, so it fits with observations. While if we assume that these air processes are produced by neutron star mergers, what they got is this black point. So the time, the merger time that they assume, that it could be wrong because this is all very speculative, it was too long. So the mergers were starting too late, and we were observing already those elements in very old stars, so there is a problem there. Also, we see a lot of scatter here because they assume that there were only a few neutron star mergers ejecting a lot of mass. So it was not well scattered in the whole galaxy, like if you produce it in the supernova. Okay, so for the heating, also the same people show in a post-processing calculation, so this will be the evolution of density along a trajectory of a merger, and this will be the temperature going to almost to zero. And if they include in a post-processing stir the energy produced by the mergers, they saw that the temperature increases. And we have done that together with Brian and Gabriel, and for different trajectories, this is the energy generation, and this will be the temperature. And we see that this can have some consequence that Brian will explain later on the merger dynamics. And what is important here is this is all done post-processing, but since it has an important impact on the dynamics, it would be good to include it into the neutron star merger simulations. However, this is very time-consuming, so we will. What we are doing now is a very simple model where we want to provide a table or a simple routine with some input given from equation of a state and from the simulation, and we will give as an output the energy generation, the change of the proton number, and the change of the abundances. So in the next months, probably you will see the results and you can use them. Okay, so I think I have not much time. This is the light curve of this radioactive decay, but Brian hopefully will explain it in more detail. Just say that we have changed the different mass models entering in the nucleosynthesis calculations, as we have assumed also different initial electron fraction, and we get always the same radioactive decay. And this was confirmed this year by Robert et al. Based in more recent simulation. And with this, I leave here my conclusion. Thank you very much.
All right, other questions?
Yes, regarding the results of Argus et al., they've assumed a very straightforward and simple model for chemical evolution. And I think more recent models of galaxy formation, and this has been highlighted, I think, in work by Ishimaru and company, that early in the history of the galaxy was formed from many smaller pieces. So to connect iron, the iron abundance with time, is probably wrong. In other words, before Fe over H of minus 2, time and Fe over H are disconnected. So you, in these new models of galaxy evolution, then the behavior of the R process or supernova R process abundances would be much different than what those models would show. And it's very likely that you would be able to get a very large enhancement in the R process yields from mergers because of these small pieces in which things are happening much more rapidly, possibly.
Yeah, so I must say that these are all models, and they have huge assumptions all. But and I think this galactic chemical evolution model from Nargis is weak and is really criticized by the community. But I think the Ishimaru models have also some weak points, so they can explain the air process coming from neutron star mergers from the contribution of all other small galaxies, but they cannot explain other elements in our galaxy. So I think every galactic chemical evolution has some really weak points. So I don't believe that this is the final answer, but I also don't believe that the Ishimaru models are the final answer. So I think one should work more into it. And also the event rate and the amount of mass ejected by the mergers is very speculative. So I think one should put everything into new models and constrain and put some error bars. Let's see.
Just wanted to stress the role of neutrino observations, measuring the Newey and the Newey bar average energies could be an important diagnostic for the YE of the wind.
Yeah.
So I had a question. Anyway, okay.
Did you estimate the heating time scale due to the energy generated by R process? Is it shorter or longer than the hydrodynamical time scale?
I think Brian will talk about it. So it depends on the orbital period compared with this heating time scale. You can see different effect on the merger dynamics and on the fallback dynamics.
Yeah, so it's important for matter that experiences low densities at late times. So not it's not like it's affecting the gravitational wave signal or something, but it's affecting the dynamics of matter that may be returning to the black hole. So I had a question. And you showed this, it's just a curiosity. So you showed the diagram of when you were showing the P process or the YE rich neutrino wind, you showed that when the expanding wind went through the shock, it moved all the nucleosynthesis off of the stability for a while.
Yeah.
Was that just because the heating rate increased the proton capture rate? Or because I'm used to the idea that if you heat it up, it moves the. In the R process, it moves the nucleosynthesis closer to stability.
So that was for the proton rich side.
Okay.
What happens there is in the reverse shock, you have an increase of the temperature, and this make easier all these capture reactions.
So that dominates over the
proton capture reactions. You have to overcome the Coulomb barrier. So this make this increase of the temperature. Favor this proton. In the neutron-rich side, we see, do you have also an increase of density? So this will also make that you get a bit far away from stability because you have more, also higher neutron densities there.
Any other questions?
So I guess I have a question. In your 2D simulations, when you said you had to increase the neutrino heating. How did you do that? Did you just bump up the luminosity, or did you increase the absorption cross-sections?
No, we have a parameter in the simulation that's the energy released by neutrinos. And we can, and then we relate the luminosity. So we calculate how should be the boundary luminosity to get this energy released by neutrinos.
And do you turn it off once you've launched the explosion, or is your calculation actually affected by the increased luminosity?
So this luminosity is so we have an inner boundary is below the neutrino sphere, but we don't have the neutron star. So this luminosity is prescribed evolution with time. At the beginning, we try to look at the Boltzmann transport simulations. For a longer time, we look at these Pons et al. Simulations in order to follow the evolution. And we have tried to change this evolution and this absolute value of the luminosities at the inner boundary and see how this affects the neutrino-driven winds.
Do you take into account that the neutrino sphere radii actually change with time in the calculation?
Okay, the neutrino sphere is given by the optical depth equals.
Which changes over time.
Yeah, it's changing.
Oh, and you're adjusting.
But the inner boundary. You have an inner boundary where you put some boundary luminosities, then you calculate the transport. You have then the neutrinos decouple. You have the neutrino sphere, and then it continues.
So the neutrino sphere is self-consistently determined. You have an inner boundary that's way inside the neutrino sphere.
Yeah.
Is that okay? And a comment I wanted to make is that in these two R-process sites that you've considered, there is tremendous effort that has gone into neutrino transport on the supernova side. But there's not a single detailed transport calculation for the merger case.
Yeah, so
the level of uncertainty that is present there is huge compared to the relatively small uncertainty in the core collapse case. But there, again, you said that once you include the light nuclei, the light clusters, you expect that there will be a change in the ratio of the luminosities and in the way you eject, right?
So then the 94 paper of Busli et al. Could produce the air process in supernova. Since there, a lot of effort has been done to improve the microphysics, and now we are not getting any more. Who knows? Perhaps it happens the same way.
Right, yeah, exactly. What do we do if that happens?
When we put more microphysics in the neutron star merger simulations, perhaps the results are not that optimistic. Or perhaps are even better.
So I just wanted to comment on that last point. I do think that the electron fraction in neutron star mergers is probably less dependent on the neutrinos than in the wind case, because in the wind case you have to accelerate matter off the surface through by neutrinos. So nuclei being driven off by that heating have to absorb many neutrinos to be unbound. In the merger case, some matter can be ejected by tidal forces, by gravitational forces, much faster. And so I'm not saying that it's unimportant, but I wouldn't be as surprised if the electron fraction would stay quite low in neutron star merger.
But you will have also a wind coming from
there. Yeah, no, there are other sources of mass that would be affected by the luminosities, like winds from the...
It will probably also depend on how long you have this hypermassive neutron star surviving the merger of remnant before you make a black hole, right? Because once you make the black hole, you lose this huge amount of luminosity that you have from that merged hot object, and you only have the disk left.
Right. So if the neutrino wind from the hypermassive neutron star is an important part of the mass ejected, then yeah, I think that would obviously depend on the transport through the.
Okay, so great. Thank you, Modena, again.